Physics McGill. I heard about this talk from students last year because they gave it, or a form of this talk was given to the Center for Inquiry in December of 2010. It's been modified to suit the Freaky Friday sort of audience, and a little bit of a preview of this was given by Bill last Sunday morning. It aired on CBC Radio 1 at 8 in the morning as part of All in the Weekend. The producers of that show will be pre-promoting our Freaky Fridays this term with a feature interview with all the scientists. So this Sunday, 8 a.m. this Sunday, CBC Radio 1, 88.5 FM, Emily Bamforth, who will be giving the Freaky Friday next Friday on the misunderstanding of dinosaurs that actually got the above the fold photo here in the reporter. And Emily's with us tonight. Here's Emily. If you need to have any advance information, she's with us tonight. So Freaky Fridays has started with a vengeance, and Freaky Sundays, you can hear about your Freaky Friday on Freaky Sunday at 8 in the morning. Bill is currently Assistant Professor of Physics here. He's a scholar with the Canadian Institute for Advanced Research, Brackett's Nanoelectronics Program and Quantum Information Processing Program. He's a member of the Institute of the Transdisciplinaire d'Informatique Quantique, affiliated with the Institute for Quantum Computing at the University of Waterloo. He did his two postdoctoral fellowships, one at the University of Waterloo, one in Basel, Switzerland. His PhD is from Basel. His master's was from McMaster, and his BSc was physics at the University of Manitoba. I don't know anything else about him. I'm just glad he's here and that you're here to listen to him. It is being taped tonight on behalf of Communications McGill, Communication Services. It will probably be available as a podcast within a few weeks' time. You can get that through the platform. It's under Multimedia, University Relations, right? I think it's about four levels down from Public Relations, that website, under the McGill homepage. Thank you, everyone. The floor is yours.
Thank you for that warm welcome, so thank you very much for the opportunity to talk to you about kinds of things that excite me about quantum mechanics, and to maybe get some information, some feedback from you guys about what you don't know or what you might find interesting about what quantum mechanics can tell us. So during my presentation, I'm not sure if it's a standard feature of Freaky Fridays, but during my presentation, I would encourage the audience to go ahead and just ask questions. Anytime during the presentation, you can raise your hand and say, I don't really know what the heck you're talking about. Can you explain that a little bit better? And I'm happy to try to do that, okay? I'm not going to guarantee that I'm going to be able to achieve that success, because a lot of these things that I'm going to tell you about are very non-intuitive. And in fact, so some of these ideas are encompassed in a joke that I heard recently. And the joke is, so how do you know that you're dealing with a member of the quantum mafia? Does anyone know?
They make you an offer you can't understand.
Okay, so just to get things rolling here, just so you know, things are going to be a little bit confusing at times, and the reason for that is because the underlying principles of quantum mechanics don't always follow our kind of deep, bare-bones intuition. In spite of that, I'm going to try to convince you that the underlying laws of quantum mechanics are what we need in order to understand the world around us. Okay? And before I get into the deep scientific background of quantum mechanics, I wanted to tell you a little bit about what was going through my mind when I was trying to get this talk ready. And so I was told that there were these things called Freaky Friday lectures, so I thought freaky. And I was told that the lecture would be followed by a movie. And then I was told I would be giving the lecture on Friday the 13th. So this is the first thing that came to my mind. Unfortunately, I don't think that this image conveys anything about quantum mechanics. So I don't want you to think that quantum mechanics is a nightmare. And in fact, I'll tell you it's really the opposite of a nightmare. By the end of this lecture, I hope to convince you that quantum mechanics is really the opposite of a nightmare. So it's not something scary, not something dangerous, not something frightening, like this hockey mask might suggest. In fact, it's much better. But then, you know, I had to think, okay, well, we're on the theme of movies now. So what other movie would convey the ideas of quantum mechanics? And I thought about the uncertainty principle. The uncertainty principle says you really can't know everything. If you know the position of a particle, you cannot know how fast it's going, according to quantum mechanics. If you know how fast it's going, you cannot know its position. This issue comes up a lot in quantum mechanics, and it's going to come up again when I talk to you about something called superposition. So the superposition principle in quantum mechanics also says that in some sense, some things can be in two places at once, or they can be in two states at the same time. And so when you look at them, you don't know what you're going to get out. You don't know whether you're going to get state one or state two. You don't know if it's going to be in place one or place two. So you don't really know what you're going to get when you look at something in quantum mechanics, and that's sort of weird. So that made me think of this movie Forrest Gump. Have you seen the movie Forrest Gump? So I thought, you know, quantum mechanics is like a box of chocolates. Because you never know what you're going to get. So that helps. That helps us understand a little bit more about what quantum mechanics is all about, and it follows this theme of the movies a little bit. But then I started thinking some more, and I thought, okay, this is a little bit superficial. Quantum mechanics is like a box of chocolates. It seems a little bit too simple. I mean, the box of chocolates usually has a code. You know which chocolate you're going to get. At least I always look at the code before I go into the box of chocolates. I don't take them around. So I started thinking again, so what is more like quantum mechanics? What is something that really conveys this idea of quantum mechanics? And I said, quantum mechanics is not a nightmare. It's not frightening. It's not scary. It's the opposite of a nightmare. This analogy is not due to me. So it's due to someone known as, at least as far as I know, I've seen him present this analogy in talks. A computer scientist at IBM, Charlie Bennett, came up with this analogy. He said, quantum mechanics is like a dream. So quantum mechanics explains these things that are sort of in two states at once. They can be more than one thing at the same time. And that sounds weird. But there's another thing about quantum mechanics. And the other thing about quantum mechanics is that if you look at something that's quantum mechanical in the right way, it will suddenly collapse. This is called collapse. It will find one particular state. And that's sort of like a dream. Have you ever had a dream where you're dreaming the dream and you think you know what's going on during the dream? You wake up in the morning and you're not sure what the dream was all about. It could be that the dream was about you riding an elephant and swimming across the ocean, or it could be that the dream was about you flying through the universe and then grasping the sun and exploding. And you don't really know what the dream was about until you start to write down the dream. But if you go through that effort of writing down the dream, or you explain the dream to someone else, suddenly the dream solidifies. And the act of conveying the story of that dream is sort of like the act of doing a measurement in quantum mechanics, sort of like projecting the state of the system. And you get the information about what this dream was sort of through the act of conveying what the dream was. So quantum mechanics is a little bit like a dream. And the movie that you're going to see after this talk really follows this theme. So if you watch this movie, Existenz, it talks about, or it explores this idea that people are working in a kind of world that's very different from the world that we're in. So they live in some kind of game world, a video game, and it's sort of like a dream as well. You never know whether you're in the dream or whether you're not, and you don't know if something is one way or another way. But at every instant during the movie, it seems like you have a kind of different reality. So it seems like you really know what's going on. Okay, so quantum mechanics is like a dream. I want you to keep that in mind throughout the whole talk. And I'll try to talk to you a bit more about concrete stuff now and try to convey to you how exciting this idea of quantum mechanics is for me. Okay? And like I said, whenever you feel the need, just raise your hand or shout out to me. Tell me that you don't understand something I said or that you think something is a bit silly, and let me know. Give me feedback. Tell me where I'm going, okay? So, and then I'm happy to change the direction of the talk a little bit to your liking. Okay, so one principle that I follow in my life, and I would encourage you to sort of imagine might be true, is that quantum mechanics is essential for our everyday existence. If we didn't have quantum mechanics, we wouldn't be able to explain a large number of everyday phenomena. One classic example is just the fact that when metal heats up, it glows red. So that red color, the fact that the metal glows red, can only be explained if we understand that the light coming off of that metal is quantized. It comes in individual units, individual light photons. If we did not have that light came off in individual units, little particles, photons, then it turns out you would not be able to understand that metal glows red when it heats up. And this phenomenon was explained by Max Planck at the turn of the century, not the last century, but the one before that, going into the 20th century. And he was able to show that unless we consider the quantum mechanical features of light, there is no way that we can understand that something as simple as glowing metal would be red. Okay? There are a number of other examples. So one example is the laser. So we all use lasers every day. It's almost impossible not to use a laser in our daily lives. Anytime you read a CD or a DVD in your computer, anytime you run a Blu-ray to watch a movie, you're using a laser. So I have a laser here, you can see. This kind of thing is common. You can buy this off the shelf. It's not something strange. It's something completely normal. And a laser relies on quantum mechanical principles as well. So a laser also relies on the fact that energy levels are discrete. You don't have any possible energy, any possible wavelength of light coming out of this laser. It's very different from an incandescent bulb, so one that just boils off a random distribution of light wavelengths. You have a very well-defined wavelength, a well-defined quantum of light coming out of here. Okay, so you have well-defined quantized energy levels in this device, and those quantized energy levels give rise to a single color, so in this case, green. And we use lasers for almost everything, as I mentioned already, CDs and DVDs and Blu-rays, but also for networks and communications, so our daily communications through any telecom fiber rely on lasers, single pulses of light of a single color. There are other examples from the medical profession. So if anyone here has ever had an MRI scan, or if anyone knows of anyone else who's had an MRI scan done, then what is being done is really to measure the quantum mechanical evolution of individual magnetic moments. So like little bar magnets in your body. Every single hydrogen atom in your body has a little bar magnet at its center, at its core, in its nucleus. And that little bar magnet, it processes, it moves around in a circle when you apply a magnetic field. And so what an MRI machine does is it applies a really big magnetic field, and it tickles those little magnets in your bodies. And it tickles them at a very specific frequency. When it sees that that frequency is taken in, is absorbed, then it knows that it's located a little hydrogen atom. And locating those hydrogen atoms tells that machine where the water is. Another way of doing MRI, magnetic resonance imaging, is to look at something called decoherence, which we'll talk about later. And decoherence sounds like a very fancy word, but what it really means is how quantum mechanical behavior becomes classical behavior. How this idea that you can be in two places at once, or in two states at the same time, suddenly collapses into the possibility, or the only possibility, that you're either in this state or this state. So there are many examples from our daily lives that demonstrate quantum principles or that require quantum mechanics in order to for them to be explained. Yeah. I'm going to tell you about Schrodinger's cat in just a second. So Schrodinger's cat is exactly the next thing that I'm going to talk about. So that's perfect, the perfect introduction to the next slide. Okay, so the things I've told you so far, they do seem a little bit non-intuitive, but you see that they're connected to everyday life. And the really strange things happen when we start to take the principles of quantum mechanics beyond the atomic and molecular level, so beyond these tiny atoms, individual hydrogen atoms in our bodies, and we start to think about things that are really much larger. And this is what Schrodinger said. Schrodinger said there's something really funny with quantum mechanics. This idea that I can be over here on the right-hand side and over here on the left-hand side at the same time. And he said, if you want to see what's really, really weird about this, consider the following experiment. So imagine that I can do the experiment, an experiment where I put a cat in a box. And so Schrodinger, he said, there is a feature of quantum mechanics called entanglement, which is very strange. And it gives rise to something that he called spukhafte Fernwirkung. He's a German speaker, he's from Austria. Or it just means spooky action at a distance. I don't know if that means anything more to you. But what it really means is that you can have some kind of quantum states that somehow know about each other, even when they're very widely separated. And I'll get into that in a second. That has to do with something called entanglement. But before we get into that, I'll tell you about this really weird experiment that Schrodinger imagined doing. He didn't do it in real life. Okay? So he said, let's take a cat. Let's imagine we have a cat. We put the cat in a box. And this is where we get a little bit freaky. Okay? So imagine there is a cat in a box. And in that box, I place a poison vial. The poison vial, if it's broken, it will explode. It will fill the box with poison gas, and the cat will die. If the poison vial remains unexploded, then the cat will live. Okay, and you put a trigger on that poison vial. So you put a trigger, which would drop a hammer and break that poison vial, and the trigger is conditional on some event of a small quantum mechanical system. And in his case, he considered a very small atom, which could decay. And if the atom decayed, then the hammer would fall, the poison vial would break, and the cat would die. If the atom did not decay, the hammer would not fall, and the poison vial would not break, and the cat would live. And so he asked the question, what happens if I wait half the time it would take for the atom to decay fully? So if you wait half the time for the atom to decay fully, the atom is actually in a quantum mechanical superposition. It is in two states at the same time. It is at the same time, in some sense, excited and de-excited. So what does that mean? Does it mean that the cat is at the same time alive and dead? So can you have a very large cat that is at the same time alive and dead? And it gets even weirder. Remember that quantum mechanics is like a dream, and that if I start to write down the dream where I tell the dream to someone, I make it happen. So I've solidified the ideas in that dream. The same is true if I observe something in quantum mechanics. So if I open the box containing the cat and atom, and I see that the cat's alive, then the cat is alive. If I see that the cat's dead, then the cat is dead. I can only get one of those two answers. I cannot open the box and see that the cat is both alive and dead at the same time. Okay? So that sounds funny, but that's the way quantum mechanics works. And it's been confirmed in many, many cases. Yeah.
That was actually the criticism Schrodinger was making by creating this sort of absurd situation, or is that actually how he was conceptualizing it?
I cannot get into Schrodinger's brain and really figure out what he was doing at the time, but certainly he raised it as a criticism at the time. There was a lot of debate, and there still is actually, a lot of debate about how to interpret this result. And the conclusion that most physicists would give is that, in principle, yes, the cat can be alive and dead at the same time. If we really believe quantum mechanics as it's written down right now, that's true. But there are still people who criticize this possibility. And indeed, there are still people who look to see if it's possible that there is some size of cat beyond which quantum mechanics does not exist anymore, and somehow the rules change. It's interesting that you bring that example up, because there are many people who do study this possibility, the possibility to put things in states of two position at the same time that would experience a different gravitational field, and it's a very interesting possibility to try to measure the force of gravity, for instance, by creating superpositions.
Exactly. So the atom itself, it will decay in some time.
Never decay totally, like uranium.
That's right.
At like 3,000
years.
Right.
So if I wait for the half-life, then I have a 50-50 probability of having the atom excited or unexcited.
You're not accepting that the cat is an observer. If there was a person in the box, you would accept them as an observer, and they would know whether they're alive or dead. But
it all
you're
depends.
Not accepting it, not you specifically, but the Schrodinger's not accepting the cat as an observer.
Yeah.
So,
Your criticism is well taken. So what you're saying, and this is something that is often debated, is that if we put an observer in the box, then the observer would actually become part of the system that we're considering. And according to the rules of quantum mechanics, the observer would end up being in superposition along with the cat and the atom. So you would have a superposition of a state where the atom has not decayed, the cat is alive, and the observer concludes the cat is alive. And the state where the atom has decayed, the cat is dead, and the observer concludes that the cat is dead. For people outside the box, that's a reasonable conclusion. That's right. So quantum mechanics, as it's taught in most universities, it usually considers what's called a closed system first. So this is a system where you have a box, and nothing can get in and nothing can get out for some period of time. And then everything works very well. It gets a lot more confusing when you start to consider what's called an open system, which is what you're discussing. And this is really an important field of study, and it's also something that I work on a lot, trying to understand how to properly describe something that can communicate with the outside world. So how do you communicate? What kind of information can pass from one way or another? How can you understand these things, these issues of collapsing the wave function? It's a very good point, and it's really something that people are still looking into. I would say we do know the basic rules, and we know how to treat a lot of different systems, and they have been tested in the laboratory to some point. But there is no question that no one has done this particular experiment to the level where they can say if the cat is in a superposition of alive and dead, although I'll tell you about progress in that direction. Are there other questions? So I really like it when you guys just send me a barrage of questions.
Hello?
Yeah, sorry.
Cat.
I'm sorry?
I hope they actually haven't done the cat.
No, no one has done this experiment. Don't worry. The cats are still fine. All the cats are fine.
No cats were injured.
No cats were injured in the making of this presentation. But so I wanted to reiterate these two concepts that I've sort of alluded to very, very briefly. The first concept is superposition, this idea that you can somehow in quantum mechanics be in two states at the same time. You're over here, and you're over here at the same time. You're in a superposition of being at this place or at this place, or you're in a superposition of being in, for instance, an excited state or an unexcited state of an atom. And the other one is entanglement, which I've sort of avoided talking to you about in detail. Entanglement is a kind of correlation. So we're all familiar with correlation. We know if the price of oil goes up, that the value of the Canadian dollar will go up, and the price of oil goes down, the value of the Canadian dollar will go down. So we know about classical correlations, so things that are tied together. Entanglement is also a kind of correlation, but it is stronger than any correlation that you can get in classical mechanics. And I find it very difficult to explain how this entanglement works and how it goes beyond those classical correlations. But you have to accept for me that there are some formulas that we can write down that tell us that the value that we can get for that formula, so the end result after the equals sign for that formula, has a bound. This is something that's called a Bell inequality, named for a guy named John Bell. So that Bell inequality will tell us if a quantum mechanical system is entangled. In other words, if it has some kind of correlation that is even stronger than we would ever possibly be able to get with classical mechanics. And this has been measured in the laboratory. So we know that there is a feature of quantum mechanics which cannot be explained by classical mechanics. And you can measure this quantitatively and prove it. Okay?
So superposition and entanglement. And these are the two things that are believed to give rise to the power of quantum mechanics, so the ability of quantum mechanics to do things that we cannot do in classical mechanics. So now we come back to this idea of Schrodinger's cat. And physicists like to write down equations, so I write down an equation for you. But this is the only equation that I will write down, almost the only equation I will write down for the rest of this talk. Okay. So in physicist language, we describe something called a superposition, which I've illustrated schematically on the left with a cat that's both alive and dead at the same time, as a sum. So we add a cat that's alive to a cat that's dead. Okay? And that's the way that we represent things. So this we really do. You replace the cat with something a little bit more fancy and mathematical, but more or less that's exactly what I do on a daily basis. So I write down this kind of equation with a cat that's alive and a cat that's dead. And so how can we imagine doing this in real life? How can one imagine making a cat that's alive and dead at the same time? Well, we start from the bottom up. So we know that a cat has a lot of atoms in it, and we can think of those atoms as being, in some sense, in one state in a live cat and in another state in a dead cat. So some colleagues of mine have started to build cats one atom at a time. Not real cats, just simulated cats. One atom at a time. So atom by atom, they're able to trap these individual atoms by stripping electrons off of those atoms. They ionize them. They become positively charged. And then they apply time-varying electric fields to trap those atoms in space. So those atoms are trapped in space, in free space, with nothing around them, just vacuum. And then they can put in another atom, and another atom, and another atom, until they make one of these little beaded necklaces of atoms. And those atoms can sort of shake against each other, and they can play with those atoms with lasers. So by shining a laser on an atom, they can make the atom, put the atom in an excited state, which we can think of as being alive, or in a ground state, an unexcited state, which we can think of as the atom being in a dead state. Okay, and if I do that with one atom, no one is really surprised that quantum mechanics works because we've seen it in a laboratory many, many times before. The thing that would really surprise people was if we can make this kind of Schrodinger's cat state with many, many atoms. And so they've been doing this. They've been working extremely hard on putting together more and more atoms to try to get a bigger and bigger cat. And the world record, which was achieved just last year, is now 14. I wrote 2010 there. The paper was published in 2011. So now we're up to 14 atoms. So how far do we have to go before we get to the size of a real cat? Anyone have a good guess?
Trillion.
Sorry?
Trillion.
A trillion. That isn't even close.
Okay. A zillion.
Yeah, 10 to the 24 is a good estimate. So there's a ringer in the audience, someone who's already estimated the size of a cat in atoms. In his spare time. So 10 to the 24 is a pretty good estimate for the size of a cat. And 10 to the 24 means a 1 followed by 24 zeros. So can you imagine? Instead of 14, you need a 1 followed by 24 zeros, atoms, in order to reproduce something roughly the size of a cat. And that's a bit ambitious. And I want to convince you in the rest of this talk that it's not necessary to do something so ambitious to really use quantum mechanics for something very useful. Okay? To do something with quantum mechanics that we would not be able to do otherwise. And what could we do? Well, okay, so let's first explore the possibility of making a really big cat. And if we want to make a big cat, there are problems. And the main problem is known as decoherence. This is the thing that converts a quantum mechanical system into a classical system. So as we get bigger and bigger systems, this decoherence gets worse and worse, and eventually all of the quantum mechanics that we build into that system is going to die. So decoherence you can think of as being just like, you know, if your hard drive crashes. If you have a quantum system, you store some information in it, or you put some information into that state that defines that quantum system, and that information just disappears. Due to interaction with the outside world. So it's really just like when your hard drive crashes, except in the quantum world, you can think of it as being, you know, sort of a blurring or a fuzzying of the quantum state, so that it's no longer precisely defined. And this gets worse and worse as we make bigger and bigger systems. But it's not necessary to make really gigantic systems in order to really do something useful. Okay? We already had this question from the audience about whether it really is quantum mechanics that makes the cat alive or dead, or if it's really something else. And indeed, there is research in the direction of saying, okay, maybe there is really some size where things really do change. But what can quantum mechanics do for us? Okay? If we can't make a cat that's 10 to the 24 atoms large, what can we do with just a few atoms, on the time scale before classical mechanics comes in and messes everything up for us? So the rest of the talk is devoted to telling you what kinds of things you might be able to do, provided you can extract those quantum mechanical features. Before I go on to some real applications that we might use in our everyday lives, I wanted to dispel some misconceptions. So you might have read in the literature that quantum mechanics allows us to do teleportation, like in Star Trek. It's kind of similar in the sense that you can take a quantum particle, you can put it in a quantum mechanical state over here, you can take another quantum particle which is not in the same quantum mechanical state, and you can make this quantum state die, and the quantum state of the other particle over here can regain that quantum state. Okay? And this is something that uses quantum mechanical entanglement, and it's done on a daily basis, so regularly in the laboratory, on single quantum particles, single photons of light, or even single atoms. Okay? So you're able to take the quantum state, to take the full description of some individual photon, individual quantum of light, and turn it into the same quantum mechanical description of another photon, another quantum of light. But doing this on the scale of the whole human body is probably way beyond anything that we could ever hope to do for the reason of decoherence. And this analogy with the cat tells us that as we scale the size of the system up too much, we're going to get into big trouble. Another thing you might have heard is that entanglement, this quantum correlation, might give us a way of communicating over long distances. So you might think that this argument that I made, that quantum entanglement sort of, it tells you what kind of state a quantum particle will be in over here, provided you know the state of the quantum particle over here. But that knowledge doesn't necessarily give you the ability to do communication. Okay, so it's not actually possible to do measurements over here and send information from one place to another. Okay, I'm breezing through some of these misconceptions, but I want to get to the main meat of the talk, which is really telling you what we can do that might be useful. Not on a short time scale necessarily, but something that will be fundamentally different from what we have been doing for many years. So this plot is a plot that I got off of Wikipedia just earlier today. Just tried to update this graph. And this was a graph that was made first in 1965 by Gordon Moore, who is a co-founder of Intel Corporation. They make central processing units. They make CPUs in your computers and in your phones, all of the nice electronic devices that you use today. And the idea behind making those processors faster for many, many years has been to squash more and more transistors into more or less the same area. And if you squash more and more transistors into the same area of a microchip, you have to make those transistors progressively smaller. So it turns out that the number of transistors on a microchip doubles roughly every 2 years. That's what this plot shows. The vertical axis is a logarithmic scale. So you see that it goes very quickly from something like 2,300 to something larger than 2 billion. And for the last 50 years or so, technology has really followed this curve. So every couple of years, we get twice as many transistors. We get twice the computing power that we had before. And that forces us to consider the possibility that the transistors are getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And very soon, in the next couple of years, maybe the next 5 to 10 years, we will reach the point where the transistor size is comparable to the size of a single atom. When we get to that point, we have no alternative but to think about quantum mechanics, because quantum mechanics defines the behavior of single atoms, small systems. And if we don't think about what quantum mechanics is doing, then we can't redesign these circuits in order to give us better and better computing power. But there's a very positive spin to this, and the very positive spin is that even though we're coming to a roadblock with this progress that people have seen over the last 50 years or so, there are really new ways of thinking about using quantum mechanics in order to make this work. So one of those ways is quantum computing. Even though we have some kind of roadblock on one hand, we're at a fork in the road, and we know that if we take a different path, if we go a different way now with how we're designing these circuits, we use quantum mechanics in the right way, we can do something potentially completely fundamentally different, which will allow us to make computers better. Okay? And this idea is quantum computing. It's a very powerful idea, and it relies on the fundamental principles of quantum particles that we have verified in a laboratory. So these principles of superposition and entanglement. Some of the things that we could do with a quantum computer are, for instance, factoring very large numbers. So it's not known that we can factor very, very large numbers with a classical computer efficiently, in other words, with a small number of bits. But it is known that if we had a quantum computer, a computer made up of quantum particles instead of classical particles, that we would be able to factor very large numbers with a relatively small number of what are called quantum bits, the quantum mechanical analogs of bits. And what would we be able to do if we could factor these very large numbers? So it turns out that all of the encryption schemes that you use on the internet, the so-called RSA encryption codes, rely on the hardness of this problem, the difficulty of factoring very large numbers. So you would be able to look at everyone's medical records, and you'd be able to see all of the secret data on the internet and financial transactions. And that may sound bad, but quantum mechanics also has an alternative. And the alternative is that you can send information completely securely using quantum particles. And the security of these so-called quantum key distribution schemes, quantum communication, is guaranteed by the laws of quantum mechanics. So if you believe the laws of quantum mechanics, then you believe that you can do this transfer of information perfectly securely. Moreover, these are not the only applications. So for me, as a scientist, the most exciting application of using these quantum principles is to do what are called quantum simulations. There are so many people working in physics and chemistry and biology today using enormous computational power in order to try to push the horizon a little bit further in their fields. And one of the major obstacles that they have is that they are trying to simulate or to guess the behavior of systems that are intrinsically quantum mechanical. And for reasons that will be clear very, very soon, it is extremely difficult to use a classical computer to simulate quantum mechanical behavior. In contrast, quantum mechanical systems are intrinsically quantum mechanical, and so you should be able to use a much smaller quantum mechanical system to simulate the kind of behavior that you have in, say, drugs or atoms and molecules. There are many examples of where you can use quantum simulation in order to understand, for instance, the energy level separation of different individual atoms or molecules, or to understand whether some material has properties of an insulator or properties of a conductor. Okay, and so I just wanted to reiterate that there are these two founding principles that tell us that quantum mechanics can do something for us. So one is quantum computation, and you could lump simulation in as another one of those forms of quantum computation, and quantum communication. Quantum communication is perfectly secure. So it's an interesting side point that one of the godfathers, or one of the fathers of quantum communication, so someone who co-authored the first paper on what's called quantum key distribution, this idea for secret quantum communication, works just over the hill at the Université de Montréal, Gilles Brassard. And he wrote this paper in collaboration with Charlie Bennett, who I attributed this analogy that quantum mechanics is like a dream. Okay, so now I want to tell you why it could be that a quantum computer can do something that classical computers cannot. So why could it be that it's very, very difficult to do these quantum simulations, simulations of quantum systems, intrinsically all of those, all the DNA in our bodies, all of the atoms and molecules in our bodies, they're obeying the laws of quantum mechanics deep down. And it is very difficult to have a classical computer simulate that, whereas it's much, much easier to have a quantum computer do it. And the reason for that is this superposition principle. So imagine if I have one quantum bit. A quantum bit is like a quantum particle that can be in one of two states, or it can be in both states at the same time. And if I want to describe what kind of quantum state that quantum particle is, I need two regular numbers, right? Because I have to describe it being in state 1 or state 0, or some probability of being in state 1 and some probability of being in state 0. Okay? So I need two classical bits of information in order to describe one quantum bit. Similarly, if I have two quantum bits, I need to describe the possibility that those two quantum bits, which each can be in state 1 or state 0, the two quantum bits can be in state 1-1 or state 0-0 or 0-1 or 1-0. And so I need to describe quantum mechanical superpositions of all four of those possible states, 1-1, 0-0, 1-0, and 0-1. And so I need four classical bits of information to describe that quantum mechanical state. Do you see where I'm going? So now if I put three quantum particles together, and I want to describe the complete state of those three quantum particles, how many classical bits of information do I need? I need to describe the superposition of 1, 1, 1, and 0, 0, 0, and so on, and so on, and so on. So I need 2 to the power of 3 or 8 classical bits of information. And it goes up exponentially quickly. So with a very small number of quantum bits, it becomes exponentially difficult to describe the quantum mechanical state of those particles. So if I go to 20, I suddenly need a megabit of information, classical storage. If I go to 30, I need a gigabit. If I go to 40, I need a terabit. And now if I go to 100 quantum bits, I would need 2 to the 100 classical bits. To give you an idea of how big that number is, how enormous that number is, I looked up the amount of information that Google handles daily. And Google handles about 24 petabytes per day. So information crisscrossing the internet, all of the searches that you do, all of the information that's passed back and forth, that adds up to about 20 petabytes. That's about 2 to the 56 classical bits. Right? And we're talking about 2 to the 100 when we have 100 quantum bits. So you can see that with quantum bits, quantum mechanical particles, we can do things to describe quantum mechanical systems, at least, that we would never hope to be able to do with classical systems, even with the enormous computing power of Google. And I don't know how I'm doing for time. I'll just take a quick look. I'm doing okay. So we're going to just tell you a little bit about quantum communication. So you want to know how quantum communication can work. So this is the other paradigm where quantum mechanics can really help us out. One thing that I find very reasonable to explain is something called the one-time pad. So the one-time pad is a system of encryption that was used historically by spies all over the world. They would carry around a little pad of paper with a code or a sequence of letters or numbers. And that sequence of letters or numbers would allow them to encode a message. It's called a one-time pad because they could use it only once, and then they had to destroy it. If the enemy got a hold of this one-time pad, they could also decode the messages that you were sending. But the most important part of encoding and decoding was to have this key, this pad. And if you had this key, and you share this key with someone else, then you can share a secret message. You can write some secret message in a new language, and if anyone gets that message, they can't figure it out. They can't make heads or tails of it. There's no way that they can crack the code. You can show, in principle, it's impossible to get information out of this. And yet, if you share this key, you can both encrypt and decrypt the message. And so I'll show you just how this works very quickly on the one-time pad. So imagine that Bob, over there on the left, wants to send a message to Alice, over there on the right. So Bob has some lyrics to a really nice song that he's just written. And he doesn't have the ability to sing it directly to Alice, so he sends it via this one-time pad method. And they share a cryptographic key. A cryptographic key is just a sequence of ones and zeros, so it's shown here in red. Imagine the message that Bob wants to send is encoded in ones and zeros in blue there. All Bob has to do is he does some system of binary addition. And the binary addition that he does follows the following rule. If you have a 1 and a 0, or a 0 and 1, then you place in the lower line in green, you place a 1. If you have a 1 and a 1, or a 0 and a 0, you place a 0. And so you can see that Bob adds 1 to 0 and he gets 1, and 1 to 1 to 0, and he adds 0 and 0 and gets 0, and so on, until he gets that green message. And that message contains no information associated with the original message, provided his key is completely random. Okay, so he can send that green message, and it doesn't matter who sees it. It's okay, anyone can see it. But then when Alice gets the message, she has the secret key, and if she has a secret key, she can just do the same operation. So if she sees a 1 and a 0, she writes a 1. She sees a 0 and a 1, she writes a 1. She sees a 0 and a 0, she writes a 0. And you see that Alice's message, the blue, is exactly the same as Bob's message in the blue. Okay, so provided they share this secret key, everything is okay. They can send information. It doesn't matter if the information is intercepted or seen. No one can get that information out of the message unless they have the secret key. And so the trick that you have to play is you have to somehow send a secret key from Bob to Alice. And the way that you do that in quantum mechanics, roughly speaking, is to send a secret key that will change how it behaves when it's observed. And so if you encode this secret key in quantum particles in just the right way, if someone observes what's going on when Bob sends a secret key to Alice, then Alice will figure that out. She'll know. They can talk later on and they can say, oh, well, you know, did the bits do something funny? And if that's true, then they can try to rebroadcast the key. And they know with certainty if someone was looking, because if you look at a quantum state, you solidify it. You modify its behavior. Okay? Quantum mechanics is like a dream, and if I convey that dream to someone, I sort of solidify that dream. All right? So I'll just finish off telling you where we are in the state of the art. We already talked about an experiment where we were looking at a Schrodinger's cat state, or a very complicated quantum mechanical state of up to about 10 qubits. It went up to 14. That's not very many, but certainly it looks like with very few quantum bits, we can do something highly non-trivial, because the number of classical bits we would need to do the same thing is enormous. The other thing that we want to do is quantum communication, and people can do this up to length scales of several hundred kilometers now. And it's possible that this could be extended in the near future via satellite technology to much, much longer distances. And I wanted to finish off by telling you a little bit about what I work on personally. And I work on these quantum mechanical spins. So these are these little magnetic moments that I was talking to you about that people look at in magnetic resonance imaging. It's one of my favorite playgrounds. And these things are almost everywhere. So again, these are important for possible quantum information technology, this technology that I talked to you about. But they're also important, of course, in solar energy production. If you think about the processes involved in converting light into electricity, it turns out that this spin is involved, and it's important to consider what's happening quantum mechanically to these spins, to these magnetic moments. It might be, it's an interesting avenue of study that is becoming more and more interesting. So the question is, how do birds find their way? How do they find their way when they migrate? And it's known that birds can sense magnetic fields, but it's not known what the mechanism is, for sure. And many people speculate, well, it's more than speculation at this point, many people believe that quantum mechanics is very important in this process, and that this quantum mechanical process involves little spins, so little magnetic moments similar to the ones that I've been talking to you about. Another place where quantum mechanics plays an important role, and people are progressively seeing more and more work done in this direction, is photosynthesis, the conversion of light energy into complex food sources for plants. And so I just wanted to say that, so this is my quantum playground. These are the things that I'm very excited about. And I think this is, you know, quantum mechanics is a dream, but this is basically my dream, to use these things and understand them better. I hope you enjoy the movie, which also has this theme of a dream. So thank you very much for your attention.
You used the word ionization.
Yes.
So that to me, I'm a civil engineer.
Yep.
That means you've gone to the DNA of the cell.
No.
And rearranged
ionization is where you rip one electron off of an atom. Or put one on. So in the case of the experiment that I was discussing, it's not something that I did, but my collaborators did it. They take individual atoms, and they're able to pull one electron off of those atoms. And because the atom is neutral, it has no net electric charge, when you take one electron off, it becomes positively charged. And because electrons are negatively charged. And that positive charge allows you to force the atom back and forth. It's an ion at that point. So you can force it back and forth with an electric field. And so what they did was to apply time-varying electric fields that push the atom effectively back and forth in such a way that, on average, it stays in one spot. And they're able to keep that single atom confined in this electric field, time-varying electric field, in one place. And then they can fire lasers at that atom and turn it into an excited state, an unexcited state, or one of these quantum mechanical superpositions of being excited and unexcited at the same time. They get full control of these things.
In other words, classical physics was entropy. When I took physics back in the 50s,
yeah.
The total entropy of the world was constant. I mean, that was the rules of thermodynamics. Now yeah. I'm told that the entropy is growing.
I think... I think the entropy of... if you have a completely closed system, it should be... constant or increase with time. So you can have an entropy increase with time. So
we have just disarrayed.
Yeah. Not sure how that ties in directly.
It doesn't.
So while entropy is also...
It's classical stuff. I mean, you know, Marshall and Pounder, remember those two guys?
Yeah.
Okay, and then Matheson, that was heat, light, and sound. That's as far as engineers got. Now there's no relationship like you're doing with physics.
Oh, well, I don't know if that's true. I think engineering is also an important branch of science that also uses a lot of physics. So.
Well, now it does.
Yeah.
I'm talking about
it. Okay.
The quantum communications, what medium is that using for communications? Is photons?
Typically, people use photons, and there are a couple of reasons for that. So the main reason is that photons don't like to interact so much with everything else. If you put them in a quantum mechanical state, they will stay in that quantum mechanical state for quite a long time. One of the main disadvantages to using photons is that they get lost. So if you send information over free space, so you send it through air, the individual photons have some probability of scattering off of all of the atoms and molecules in the atmosphere. And if they scatter, then they're lost. And then the receiver at the other end doesn't know if that photon was really lost or if it was taken by some observer. And so that compounds the difficulty of using these things for secure quantum communication.
Is that currently the limitation on distance?
Exactly, yes. So photon loss. And one of the options is to send these photons not directly through the atmosphere but up to a satellite. And then you go through less atmosphere going vertically up and then vertically down through the atmosphere. You can go much longer distances from point A to point B on the surface of the Earth by going up through the atmosphere vertically and then down again vertically, then by sending information, or sending single photons through the atmosphere all the way, where they might be lost. Yeah?
The question about teleportation, it looks like it should be conflict with the principle of uncertainty.
Why is that?
I don't know. No, we can't get the information about the position and the velocity of the quantum object.
How can we remove
this information?
Okay, so there's a sneaky bit of information that I swept under the rug there. You can... Even if you cannot know at any instant in time what the exact position and velocity of a particle are, you can know precisely what its quantum mechanical wave function is, what its quantum mechanical state is. So this wave function is just a word that this, you know, says, I can write down something on paper. Similar to this equation I wrote for the cat, I can write an equation that describes it's a precise description within quantum mechanics of what the thing is doing. It just doesn't tell me whether I'm going to see if the cat is alive or the cat is dead when I look at it. Okay? So there's a precise quantum mechanical description, even though I might not know the outcome of a measurement. And that precise quantum mechanical description is what's teleported.
So if I create some quantum mechanical particle which is in a quantum superposition of being excited and unexcited over here, I can teleport that quantum mechanical particle over here in the sense that the quantum mechanical description of that particle over here will be exactly the same. Even though when I measure that particle an individual time, I don't know if I'm going to see excited or unexcited. But from many measurements on many copies of that particle, I can reconstruct the quantum mechanical state, and I will know that it has been faithfully teleported.
I'm just interested in using photosynthesis. So what it requires specifically in photosynthesis is quantum mechanics, lighting. Like, I know it's all about protons and photons and electrons.
Yeah. So a lot of research recently has found that the only way to describe the process of transfer of charge from one place to another on photoreceptors in plants is to consider this quantum mechanical superposition principle. And this is a concept that was known to some extent for people working on very small electronic devices. But it's now only now being adopted by people in the biology community, in the biophysics community. So they're starting to see that yes, these effects turn out to be very important. And you cannot describe the timescales of charge transfer from one place to another on complex molecules that harvest light if you do not account for quantum mechanical features. And in particular, if you don't account for things like decoherence, this thing that destroys the quantum mechanical aspects and brings out the classical aspects of certain systems. I can give you references if you're interested.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
Thanks a lot.
Oh, thank you.